Okay.
Right. So today is the 25th of March 2019. I'm not going to accelerate my US accent because he is somebody who knows much better than me to speak in that language, and he is going to present himself first.
Hi, I'm Nick Rockwell. I'm the CTO at the New York Times.
When I saw your name popping up on the speakers list, I was afraid that you're going to speak techie stuff. You did not at all. So I wanted to speak with you about three topics which popped up in your speak. One was Walter Benjamin, the second one was serendipity, and the third one was recommendation. So that's the guideline of our interview. First, why Walter Benjamin again in your head, in your presentation, and in your future?
Well, like I mentioned in my talk, I had the fortune or misfortune of studying literary theory when I was in school, rather than computer science, for example. And some of the things that I've read have really stayed with me and continue to feel relevant. I would say Baudrillard is one and Benjamin is another. So it actually came to my mind as I was preparing my talk, which was about algorithmic recommendation. And I think it's unsurprising in that Benjamin was specifically writing about his essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, and he was writing about the impact of photography and film on society and culture and the work of art. And I think now we're in a different time where there's a different technological revolution, but these things follow some of the same patterns. So my reading of him as it applied to this moment and this instance is, in our own newsroom, one of the tensions has been, can we do recommendation when so much of what we do is apply our news judgment and tell people what they ought to know, and it's based on, you know, judgment and curation. And I felt that algorithmic recommendation was kind of a form of mechanical reproduction of that news judgment, and that, as happens, according to Benjamin, with the work of art, it felt like that's undermining our authority and the authenticity of our judgment, and not just ours, but of everybody's, and that sort of the place of authenticity and judgment in news is being challenged and called into question, and people are saying things like, oh, you know, nothing's true, none of it's true, and so on. But I also felt that he shows the way forward a little bit when he says that through being able to go to places that a single work of art couldn't, its reproductions can engage in a different way with viewers, or in our case, readers. And essentially, he uses the words meet them halfway. And I thought that was very evocative. And it tells, to me, how we, with a good recommendation strategy, can essentially meet our readers halfway, start to build trust with them little by little over time by showing that we notice them, we notice what they care about, we can be relevant to them, and hopefully win them back. So that was my Benjamin angle.
But now it's no more the mechanical reproduction, it's the digital reproduction.
Yeah. So it's even faster and even broader and even more instantaneous. Yeah.
But this sounds very linear. That doesn't sound very disruptive. So what is the linear development in this part, and what is the disruptive development in this part?
Well, I think the disruptive element is what we're seeing right now, which is this collapse of trust in media. And I think people have based trust on personalities and to some degree brands as proxies for personalities. And that's been worn down essentially by this constant onslaught of so much material and like organized in this chaotic seeming fashion. And I think also so far the algorithms that have been dominating have really not taken any kind of judgment into account. They've really been driven purely by pure optimization. And that's like the Facebook algorithm or Twitter's algorithm. And what I also spoke a bit about is like that's not any time that you optimize like ad infinitum towards a goal, you're going to get into trouble. You're going to end up in an extreme position. And everything about recommendation that makes it valuable is about balance. So that was my take on it.
When Benjamin was looking back to his own past, he had an idea that he was following up the idea of a mechanical Turk. Mm-hmm. So what's going to be your digital Turk?
That's an interesting question. So I think I would stop short of saying that our goal with recommendation is in fact to replicate news judgment. But if we're successful, we'll end up somewhere close to that. And again, never with the intention of replacing what a smart editor thinks. But nonetheless, if we can echo that a little bit and capture a little bit of that intelligence and apply it in an individualized way to every reader, that's something that otherwise would be impossible. So in a way, it's a little bit like having a mechanical Turk, like replicating judgment on a personalized level for every reader, which would be quite an amazing thing.
I refer to that thing because in your presentation, you talked about the lack of serendipity when you look at digital media. in analog, you still have the chance to look at something you never have thought you're going to look at the next moment. In digital, you don't have. So what do you do to rediscover this kind of value in this digital environment?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I've been thinking about it a lot, and I don't have an answer yet, but I feel like it's an important problem for us to solve. And just as you say, there's something about interacting with a physical object that everybody does it a little differently. You pick it up, I read back to front, you know, people have different habits. And I think that automatically, it's also very easy to scan a page, sort of see what's on it. And that leads to people discovering things through the print form factor. In digital, it's much harder. Like there's a, you know, you have to scroll way down through something that's, especially on mobile, that's been, you know, linear. It's linear, so you can't scan in the same way that you can. So, but I don't know what the right mechanism is. But I know that it's important that we need to find it. We learn that from our user research, as well as it intuitively makes sense that with so much content, if you're only being shown things that somebody thinks you already want to see, where's the surprise in that, and where's the excitement, and where do you, how do you learn? So we have to figure that out.
But that's an interesting point. I wouldn't go too far, but what are the linking elements between trust and surprise?
That's an interesting question. I think we don't really know, but there's an element of surprise that I think reflects respect. It's like, I don't know you that well. I can't know everything about you. How about this? Whereas if your attitude is like, I know everything about you, and this is definitely what you want to see, that's not particularly respectful to people. So I think it signals an openness and a willingness to admit, you know, to potentially make mistakes, and then that can build trust.
There's something called digital design, and there's something called thinking, means thinking in a way which is based on a new technology. But on the other side, you have the traditional German idea of something called the dialectics, where you build up something new from something old. So in this triangle, maybe you're not just going to try to be trustworthy, but maybe you're going to be somebody who's triggering new ideas and new perspectives for the future, because that's the third part you have been speaking about, right?
I think that seems right. And I think, I mean, using the words trust and authenticity, and we all do, but I actually think where we're heading towards is a where if we use those concepts at all, they work very differently. Maybe we should even have a different set of concepts. And some research that we did that with younger readers that I thought was really interesting was that whereas older readers might associate trust with a particular brand or, again, a person like a Walter Cronkite or something in the US, younger readers, they're constantly like creating a quorum based on how, you know, if they see a particular statement or story like coming from many different sources, including their friends, their social circles, it's like a quorum approach. And at a certain point, they feel that it's more likely to be trustworthy, but they're constantly sort of tallying in this way. So they have a completely different approach, or they may have a completely different approach to building up their perspective on authenticity or what serves as authenticity to them, serves their purpose. So, but I think we have a lot more to learn about how these concepts work in a super digital world.
But there's something I learned from you, and I think I should agree on that one. Artificial intelligence is never going to replace our own pursuit of happiness. What do you think about that one?
I think that's definitely true. And I try not to use the phrase artificial intelligence because it's super ambiguous and I don't really know what it means. So I'll talk about machine learning because I kind of know what that is, but I don't really know what AI is. But what I will say is whatever it is and whatever it becomes in the future, it's not going to be the same as what we are, in the same way that I wouldn't try to replace really human curation with algorithmic recommendation. They're just going to be different things. So let's let them be different things. I think advanced machine intelligence will probably be very valuable to us, but it's not going to be the same as the way I think or the way you think.
So maybe before we end this talk, we just maybe should say that in the word artificial intelligence, we have the word art. Mm-hmm. And maybe art is going to give us a new horizon for perspectives which we have lost in the traditional editorial industry?
I think it could. What I think of when you say that is this idea that I've been sort of trained to think of art and science as these opposed entities. And I think that's not a belief system that's going to benefit us in the future. We really need to try to push past that to some synthesis in your, you know, in your dialectic. So I've observed directly that solving like complicated machine learning problems is as much art as science, and it requires deep insight and creativity from, you know, researchers to understand the internal dynamics of a problem and how to apply a bag of techniques that are really what machine learning is. I think that'll probably be even more true of artificial intelligence when we can design an intelligence. How do we design that intelligence, and what, you know, with outcomes we can't even predict, like what instincts guide us? And I think that is likely to feel like an artistic process. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Rick, you've been invited here in Germany. You've been the last one on today's show. And we are sitting here just between the last moment of your talk and the bottles of beer standing next to you. And you still are hesitating because you're doing this interview. So instead of asking all kind of question, let's play a last very simple mind game.
Okay.
Imagine all the questions I could have asked.
Mm-hmm.
Make up one of those, your own question, and give an answer to that one.
Here's a question. I think, you know, we see what the internet does, and it converges on winners. And then it does leave room for a whole lot of niche players. So if we think of movies, it's like Netflix is a winner, and, you know, there are like niche players who focus on horror movies or this or that, and that's even more true in the world of news, but it's very hard on everybody in the middle. But that middle ground is such a rich and fertile field, especially in news and publishing, that really helps us understand our world. So how, as I think the internet inevitably like converges us towards a handful of winners and a bunch of, you know, very, very, very splintered and remote niches, how do we preserve some of that value in the middle, and how do we not end up in a world where that's much more homogeneous and has much fewer viewpoints in it? I think that's a really important question.
Thank you, Rick, for your inspiring insights.
Thank you.